We got a problem today. How do you do a talk show about a subject people don't like to talk about? The subject? Domestic violence. It's disturbing. It's embarrassing. It's hidden. And yet it happens, probably more often than statistics reveal. But something happened last week that made one community try to bring some light to domestic violence. A Muslim woman living in upstate New York was beheaded. Authorities have charged her husband with the crime. And the facts behind the case suggest this ultimate violent act follows a history of domestic abuse. Before we can do something about the problem, we need to talk about it, in our churches, in our schools, in the open. Tell us your story. In your community, do people talk about domestic violence? Enough? Too much? Is it helping? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org, and you can join the conversation at our website. Go to npr.org and click Talk of the Nation. Later in the hour, what you want to hear from President Obama tonight when he addresses Congress. But first, Asra Nomani is the author of Standing Alone, An American Woman's Struggle for the Soul of Islam, an adjunct professor of journalism at Georgetown University. She is also a contributing writer for The Daily Beast, where she has been covering this story, and she joins me here in Studio 3A. Welcome.
Thank you.
So I guess the first thing we have to talk about is this case. What happened here?
Well, this case involves two people who were mini celebrities in our American Muslim community, Asiya Hassan and her husband Muzammal Hassan. They had started a new venture called Bridges TV, an American Muslim TV channel. I got a phone call in my home in Morgantown, West Virginia, a few years ago asking for a donation, and I agreed to give it, even though I don't usually donate to causes. And I did it because there was a need for American Muslim identity put out there in the media. And so they were a big couple. And then sadly, what happened was over the last few years, we have at least documentation for, Asiya was living a private life of hell at home. She was living under the threat of violence and sometimes violence from her husband. This was a secret in the community, except some people did know about it. In the Rochester Muslim community, where Muzammal Hassan had had a first marriage and then a second marriage that had been marked with domestic violence. And then it culminated in February with her death.
Wow. Is there... Did she seek help? Was she able... Did she have any place to go to get help?
Yeah, you know, I have in front of me, you know, a police report from Texas, where Muzammal Hassan's family lived, and they were on a visit there in 2007. She walked into the police station with a protective order from New York. She'd gotten three protective orders before that one that she was carrying, and she wanted to know if the Texas police could enforce this protective order. The police officer tried to take notes on her case. She was there with her brother-in-law, and she said, "Why are you taking notes?" He said, "I'm obligated," because she had shown him bruises that she had on her body. And she said, "Oh, no." And literally the police officer said, fled the station with the police officer saying, "Please wait." So the documentation is that indeed she'd gone through the police system. There were many cases where the local police in New York State had responded to calls for help. And ironically and interestingly, the protective order that she had said that her husband, Muzammal Hassan, had to get counseling and anger management classes from Catholic Charities in upstate New York.
So if the system was turned on by this event, if the protective orders were issued, if things happened, what went wrong?
I think what went wrong is that this conspiracy of silence that you made me think about at the introduction is what in fact crippled and possibly paralyzed her from leaving this marriage and leaving the danger that she faced in this marriage. There is so much pressure on women, not only in the Muslim community but in so many communities, to tough it out, to stick around. And in this situation, there was this issue of the public face that needed to be protected, and there was that possibility of public shame if it became known that there was this issue of violence in the home.
Yeah. Well, I want to invite another guest to join us now. This is this story of this beheading was the focus of many Friday sermons at mosques around the country. And Imam Muhammad Majid is executive director of the All Dulles Area Muslim Society and vice president of the Islamic Society of North America. He wrote an open letter to the leaders of American Muslim communities last week calling this murder a wake-up call. He joins us from his office in Sterling, Virginia. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for inviting me.
So what did you say to your congregants this week, and what were you hoping to have them hear?
I spoke about the issue of domestic violence as being an issue that need to be addressed and discussed in our schools, in our youth meeting. I spoke about the fact that many people might believe that domestic violence does not take place in our community. And also I address the women in my congregation that should not feel any kind of shame if they have been abused. They have to come forward and to inform the authority, and people in the mosque has to be supportive because there's no shame for a woman to get out of a relationship, but the shame is supposed to be on the abuser. Therefore, I would try to do is to address it in the social level, but also from the Islamic perspective that Islam does not approve of the issue of domestic violence or violence against women. The Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, himself never hit a person in his life. And therefore, I put it on those principles. But I used the incident that of the respected sister Asya Hassan, in God bless her soul, in New York, as the example that no woman should be second guessed when she says that I feel being abused, I feel unsafe in my home, I feel my life is threatened. Immediately, the police, the community, a judge, supposed to take that very serious. We have so many incidents where a woman was second-guessed and her life ended. Today, just in Washington Post, there's an incident of somebody shot his wife.
Wow. But I'm curious, do you have any sense, first of all, that this is a message that that people don't yet understand, and did you feel that your sermon got through to them?
I think the people were very understanding, and many people have become very supportive. In matter of fact, we had two organizations in my community deal with the issue of domestic violence. One of them called Peaceful Family Project, and another organization called Faith. Both of them were present on Friday, giving literature, and on Friday night, again, we did a special prayer for Asya Hassan, and I gave a talk, and the organization were there to give materials and information to the public.
Right. I want to address this question to both of you, because I think it's an important one. Are either of you concerned that this incident will make the Muslim community appear to have more of a problem with domestic violence than other communities? Why don't I start with you, Asra Nomani?
Well, it's definitely become a symbol for critics who want to, castigate honor killings appropriately and lash out against Sharia, in many cases with legitimate reasons. I know that there's a lot of people who are very upset that there's been an association of Islam with this death. But I think that what we have to do is accept responsibility for the fact that, we in our American Muslim community are basically where the larger community was in the 1950s in their understanding of domestic violence in America. churches at that time were very widely, you know, gave this message that a man had that kind of authority over a woman. And sadly, in our mosques, we are still grappling with trouble over this interpretation of a chapter and verse in our Quran that literally read will say that a man has a right to lightly beat his wife. In my own mosque in West Virginia, this was preached from the pulpit. We were given books that said you can beat your wife as long as you don't leave black and blue marks on her face. And so what's happened is that we've had something that I call a 434 dance, because this chapter is chapter 4, verse 34. And it's been a dance about, well, you can hit her, but just hit her with a wet noodle. Or if you want to hit her with the back of a rolled up newspaper. I mean, these are literally teachings that people hear. And so this is what I think we have to confront and be honest about, and then say very clearly, like, we have a zero tolerance policy. We don't do the dance. And I'm so excited about the letter that Imam Majid, for example, put out there, because it's clear. I mean, his letter is a clear message that homes have to be loving and homes need to be peaceful, and that a man doesn't have that kind of authority over a woman. And that's a message that we, I think, still need to communicate within our community.
Imam Majid, we've only got about a minute before the break, but do you want to address that question? Do you think that this incident will make the problem to be appear to be more more of an issue in the Muslim community?
The fact that the domestic violence that takes place in every community, sometimes this have been ignored. That we have religious leaders who met in April 5th, 2006, and they have issued national declaration by religious and spiritual leaders to address violence against women. And you can find that in Faith Trust Institute website, where all of us, Anglican, Catholic, Jewish, Muslims, have signed that declaration, and we have said that we acknowledge that our texts.
Imam Majid, I'm going to have to interrupt you there. We'll come back to this question after the break because it's an important one, but we do have to take a short break. We're talking about how communities talk about the issue of domestic violence, and we're taking your calls at 800-989-8255. I'm Joe Palca. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Joe Palca in Washington. Domestic violence is not an issue people like to talk about. Today we're trying to talk about it. Tell us how your community talks about domestic violence. Do they talk enough? Too much? Is it helping? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org. And you can join the conversation at our website. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. My guests this hour are Asra Nomani. She's been covering the story of a New York executive charged with beheading his wife. We have a link to her coverage in the Daily Beast at npr.org/talk. And Imam Mohammed Majid is also with us. He's executive director of the All Dulles Area Muslim Society. And Imam Majid, you were just answering the question about whether or not this issue, or this issue of domestic violence, or this case, this particular case of domestic violence, was going to make it appear that this was a bigger problem in the Muslim community than other communities.
Yeah, I was saying that in the declaration that we have signed in 2006, declaration says we acknowledge that our sacred texts, tradition, and values have too often been misused to condone abuse. And therefore, it is true that some people misuse religious texts to do that. But I would like to say that as an imam, I would like to address the issue in my own community. Therefore, I would like to make sure, as Asra have said, that the imam or the person who's teaching our youth have not misused religion or Islam to justify domestic violence.
Right.
It is true this case has brought the issue of domestic violence in the Muslim community to light. But we should use that as an opportunity to educate our community in the issue of domestic violence.
Right, exactly. Well, thank you for that. And let's take a call now and go to Allison in Toledo, Ohio. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure.
I just wanted to talk a little bit about what domestic violence can be like in a smaller community besides being in a religious community. I'm a college student at the University of Toledo. And I myself have had to go through the court proceedings against an abuser. And the situation, it seems to be, when college students are victims of domestic violence, other people don't want to admit that the people around them are, you know, participating in those kinds of things, whether it be because they don't think that someone as educated as them can have that going on, or that, you know, in that kind of environment, that the person next to you who has all the same things as you, has a dorm room, has food to eat, has friends, has a girlfriend, has an education, it seems that people are less likely to believe those kinds of things that are going to happen, just like people are less likely to believe that a executive is going to, you know, beat his wife. And I wonder, you know, what kind of mass effect that has on everybody, where in a small community, if we aren't willing to admit that it's going on, how can we look at it as a larger picture?
But have you, Allison, if I can ask, have you been able to share this experience with your classmates, with the community? Is it something that if would people in your dorm or in your classes be surprised to know about this, or do they know about it?
It's generally something people don't talk about. I mean, we tend to avoid the unpleasant. I personally have shared my story with people that it's come up with, but it's a difficult thing to talk about. When it was going on, however, I had a boyfriend that had abused me for several years and then consequently stalked me for two. And it took 2 years for me to be able to even get a protection order against him, because when I tried to talk to professors and attorneys even, people didn't want to admit that the situation was as grave as what it was. And I was in danger, but nobody would take me seriously because people don't want to, you know, admit that a young girl is in that kind of situation. And it's very dangerous. My own parents are both employees of the legal system, and they themselves were in a lot of denial over it. And then when I went through the actual court proceedings and things like that, I even had a judge say to me, "Why didn't you have your family take care of it for you?" And I said, it's not that simple, you know. It's a very complicated issue of having to deal with the relationship between an abuser and a victim. And on top of that, to be in an environment where you don't feel like you can talk about it, and the people around you don't want to admit that that's happening. People don't want to see the bad things if they don't have to.
Right. Well, let me ask Asra Nomani, you hear this story from Allison, does any of this resonate with the experience in the Muslim community, or is this...
Yeah, it absolutely does. I mean, I think what Allison is talking about is such a universal phenomena of this conspiracy of silence that any community does in order to pretend an issue doesn't occur. And I've seen it in traditional societies of all sorts. I came from rural West Virginia myself, and in West Virginia, they had to pass a law that said that men would lose their license for their guns if they didn't, you know, stay out of domestic violence court. I mean, they had to use that kind of leverage over men in order to make them hold them accountable. And I really know that it must have been a struggle for Allison, and congratulate you for your courage, because I only think that through speaking out will we get healing.
Allison, thank you very much for calling.
Thank you.
Let's go now to caller number, let's go now to Kelly in Rochester, New York. Kelly, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I actually called up because there's another community that doesn't talk a lot about this, as is, you know, everyone's finding out, and that's the gay and lesbian community. And I think that certainly people can be shocked that partner abuse could happen within a lesbian relationship. And I think there are many people out there, lesbians included, who feel like they've left all of that dynamic behind because they're not dealing with men, that gender-specific kind of behavior that we've kind of all had drummed into our heads, you know, it's something that happens in other communities. And a lot of, I think, women can be really shocked to find that they can still be victims of intimate partner abuse, domestic violence, in a same-sex relationship. It can be shocking. People don't want to talk about it. And certainly in our communities, they don't talk about it, but it's something that really needs to get out there.
Interesting. Kelly, and I want to turn to you, Imam Majid. This actually raises a question in my mind. If you've got the double stigma, let's say, of an abusive relationship and a homosexual relationship that might be, and I don't mean the stigma that has sometimes been applied to those, is there a way to encourage people? Would you encourage someone to come to you with this issue in that circumstance?
I have not counseled people in this kind of circumstances. But I would like to say that violence against women, 90% of the people who are victim of domestic violence are women, 90%. Mm-hmm. But this, we have men who come and complain of violence against them from women.
Yeah.
But the fact that majority of the victims of domestic violence are women make this issue looks like the one gender have committed more abuse against the other. Many people come to me and say, "How about men?" Always you talk about violence against women.
Yeah.
I do address that issue, and I say I acknowledge that some men being abused by women, but the majority of the abuse or violence are against women.
Okay.
Well, one of the things that we're starting to learn now from research that's happening around the country, and a lot of college professors are taking it up, is that domestic abuse happens at about the same rates in heterosexual relationships and in gay and lesbian relationships. So, you know, within the whatever percentage of the population that happens to be gay or lesbian, we know that this is happening at the same rates. And it's about power and control, not necessarily about gender roles.
Yeah.
And one of the problems, quite frankly, that people have within same-sex relationships is a lack of awareness by the greater community, a lack of ability to counsel people because they are not aware. Your typical domestic violence shelter or counselor does not have significant understanding of what goes on in same-sex relationships, and domestic violence can look really different in a same-sex relationship. Just trying to figure out who's the primary aggressor in a lesbian relationship is hard because, you know, most of us use the stereotype of, oh, it's the man.
Right.
So if there's no man, trying to figure out just who is the primary aggressor in a relationship is hard. So I just really like to encourage people to think broadly about it. And if you're in a same-sex relationship that is abusive, to seek help. There are people out there, many of the gay and lesbian centers and organizations around the country do have help.
Okay. Well, Kelly, thanks for that call. I guess it's an important reminder that, that relationships, despite whatever their nature, can this kind of problem can occur. And Asra Nomani, did you want to add something to that?
Yeah, I really appreciate that Kelly brought it to this idea of power and control because, in my own lifetime, I was fortunate enough to become a volunteer at our rape and domestic violence shelter in West Virginia. And there I saw the power and control wheel, which is out of a prevention program in Duluth, and it's applicable to many situations, even outside of relationships, where people, when you challenge their power and control, will retaliate with emotional abuse, intimidation, isolation, and sometimes physical violence. And this is something that I think it's really great for us to understand, and that the abuser and the abused can come in so many different forms.
Yeah.
I understand.
I agree.
Yeah, okay. Let's take another call now. Go to Brian in Blackfoot, Idaho. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hi, Neil. I was calling. I'm a Mormon, and in church this Sunday, I was in a Sunday school class just with men. Now, the leaders of our church have repeatedly spoken out against abuse of any kind of family or offspring, whatever. But in this Sunday school class where there was just men there, one of the leaders of the class actually mentioned something that, well, everybody's got the right to spank their kids, and it's just a matter of getting over the idea that everybody's got the right to do what they want in their own family. And I guess I'll take my comments off the air.
Okay, Brian, thank you for that. I wonder, is it comparable, do you think, the notion of corporal punishment for a child and abuse of a spouse?
I would like to say that is one of the issue also people don't talk about it that much is abuse against children. And some, people have misunderstanding of how you can discipline your children. The way that some member of the community, whether Muslim community or larger community, deal with the discipline of the children are not acceptable.
Yeah.
Therefore, and thank God that we have organization in America and Child Protective Agency where they take this issue very serious. The problem with the children abuse or abusing of a child is that children sometimes cannot advocate for themselves, while the adult can come and tell someone. Sometimes the abuse being discovered by a counselor or a teacher. It happened that the child took off their shirt, you know, swimming or playing a sport, and then they see a mark on their back, on their body, and then they tell someone. Therefore, we would like what I would like to see happening is that in our schools, whether the religious schools or public school, the children would be encouraged, should be encouraged to come forward if there's a severe, if there's a physical abuse in their home,
exactly.
So that they can get the help they needed.
Exactly. So we're talking about the difficult subject of domestic abuse, and we're taking your calls at 800-989-8255. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's take a call now from Barbara in Rochester, New York. Barbara, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Yes, hi there. Perfect transition, your guest's last comments.
Oh, good.
I'm a school counselor. I retired about a year ago. But my point is to make it clear to the public how easy it is to actually do something about this. You know, people always think it's the other guy or, you know, that there was some huge thing to develop. And all I did was call our local domestic shelter, a terrific place, Alternatives for Battered Women here in Rochester. And they, of course, have speakers. And so I set up a yearly speaker to come to the eighth grade classes. Each year we'd rotate what subject would give up a day of classes, of, you know, teaching in their classrooms to allow the speaker to come in. So, for example, 1 week all the science classes in the eighth grade would instead spend the 45 or 50 minute class talking about dating violence, mm-hmm. and relationship violence. And, you know, it's even important to start in elementary school, but you do it at a different angle. But by the time kids are in middle school, they're definitely dating, and they need to be aware of the signs, and they need to, exactly as your guest said, talk to somebody. And being a counselor, that was something that I talked openly about so that kids would know that it was something that they could talk about and, you know, train them in how important it is to either come with a kid that you as another kid are worried about or sneak into the guidance counselor, tell the counselor that you're worried about kid X and either ask for anonymity or not, as you will. And, you know, so I just think it's important that folks understand that you don't have to be a big wig or do anything special. You just have to decide that this is an important issue and you're going to highlight it.
Right. Barbara, thank you very much for those comments.
You're very welcome.
I just to conclude, Asra Nomani, in the time, you mentioned that you've been involved in this topic for a number of years. Do you see any change? Is it getting worse, getting better?
I think it's getting better. I entered into this topic because I was challenging issues of women's roles in our mosques in Morgantown, and I was coincidentally at that time then getting my training in the Rape and Domestic Violence Center and realizing that, you know, there's a continuum in this conversation between the role of women in society and in the religious places and the attitudes we have regarding how we can treat women. And included in there then is the idea of how we treat others. And so for me as a Muslim, I felt like this issue of domestic violence was a canary in the coal mine. How you approached it was indicative of how you approached issues about violence against Jews and Christians and innocents and all the other issues that are problematic in the Muslim world. And what I've seen is that, you know, in our own Muslim community, it's a war of ideas, and I believe that through works like Imam Majid and, you know, a group called Muslim Men Against Abuse, Facebook hates accounts that have been set up because of Asiya Hassan's murder, we are waking up, just like America has been waking up.
Well, Well, we're going to have to leave the subject there, but I want to thank you very much for joining me this afternoon. Asra Nomani is author of Standing Alone, An American Woman's Struggle for the Soul of Islam. We also heard from Imam Muhammad Majid. He's the executive director of the All Dulles Area Muslim Society. Coming up, you be the speechwriter. What do you want the president to say in his address tonight? 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. I'm Joe Palca. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.